Today's show, October 14th, 2009. Before we get into the show, I want to mention that next week is a Pledge Drive special. I'm going to have a two-hour show. I'm going to have a fascinating guest on. He's Dr. Kevin Barrett. He is a PhD. He is a Muslim and Islamic studies scholar. He has his own radio show. He's at least as rabble-rousing as I am. And it should be really interesting. So I urge you to tune in for next week's two-hour Pledge Drive special. The week after that, my guest is going to be Cliff Newell, the District Attorney of Nevada County. That should also be quite interesting. All right, commentary for today, October 14th. BBC has reported that Great Britain has responded to President Obama's request and has committed an additional 500 troops to our war in Afghanistan. 500. Count them. The Taliban must be quaking in their boots. Later in the show, I'll read some articles in Afghanistan, but for now, the next item is: some listeners have been sending me articles on the issue of Barack Obama not being born in the United States and therefore not being eligible to serve as president. Here's what I wrote back to one of them. Please, stop sending me stuff on Obama not being eligible. Even if that story has any validity, which I doubt, and don't give a damn, the courts will end up tossing it out using that good old catch-all, in the interests of national security. It's a non-issue. Forget about it. He's president. Live with it. If he got tossed, which will not happen, do you honestly think the replacement would be any better? The system we live under is called corporatism. Anyone who attains that high in office does so because they've been chosen, because they'll do the corporation's bidding. Let's stick to issues we have a chance of winning. Choose your battles. Next item. The Nobel Prize Committee nominated Barack Obama for its Nobel Peace Prize less than a month after he took office. Since then, he's been anything but a bringer of peace, but they gave him the award anyway. Go figure. So this next item is quite appropriate. Breaking news! This just in. After watching one college football game, Barack Obama has been awarded the Heisman Trophy. And Andy Borowitz weighs in with his comment in SmirkingChimp.com. Nashville, the Borowitz Report. President Barack Obama stunned the country music world today by picking up its highest honor, Country Music Entertainer of the Year. Mr. Obama was chosen unanimously, according to the Country Music Association, beating out such favorites as Carrie Underwood and Toby Keith. In Nashville, country music insiders were shocked by Mr. Obama's selection, given that he has only been in office for 8 months, and during that time has yet to record a single country song. But Mr. Obama was gracious in receiving the honor, saying that he was, quote, honored and humbled by the award before excusing himself to accept this year's Heisman's Trophy. And then there's Congress saying they're looking into the Bernard Madoff scandal. Great. The guy who made $50 billion disappear is being investigated by the people who made $1.5 trillion disappear. Okay, this one is called The Real Battle Over America's Banking System. And somehow I lost the source, so I don't know who it's from, but here it is. The battle to reform the American banking system needs to include reimposing the barrier between investment banking and depository banking. That was formerly the Glass-Steagall Law amendment, which was done away with. It also needs to have pay incentives based on what's best for Americans and not just the top executives. The end of too big to fail, and other changes which are frequently discussed by financial writers. These are vital issues. But there's more to the battle for reform than you might know. New York versus the rest of the country. If you are happy with the banking system and don't think it needs to be reformed, then you probably work for one of the banks headquartered in New York. Indeed, the banks outside of New York have acted much more conservatively, used more conservative capital ratios and less leverage, and gotten less involved in credit derivatives and other speculative investments. Buy a banker in the Midwest a drink, and he'll probably rail against the giant New York banks for causing the financial crises, costing the smaller, better-run banks a lot of money and huge fees, and driving many small banks out of business. And even within the Federal Reserve, what the New York Fed and Bernanke are saying is wholly different from what the heads of the regional Fed banks are saying. The Fed banks in Philadelphia and Kansas City and Dallas and elsewhere disagree with what the New York Fed and Fed's Open Market Committee are doing. So the battle isn't between bankers versus outsiders. It's between the giant New York money-centered banks and the rest of the country. Congresswoman Marie Cantor said last week, "We used to have capital ratios. We need to get back to them. 10-1. For every dollar in your bank, you can lend 10. You know what J.P. Morgan did? 100-1. And then with derivatives, who knows how much? Remember Milton Friedman, the monetary economist worshipped as the guy with all of the answers in the latter part of the 20th century? He advocated for 100% reserves. Friedman has been deified as the economist to follow, but his reviews on reserve requirements have been completely ignored. Goldman using taxpayer dollars to buy stock in China? As everyone knows, Goldman became a bank holding company in September to be able to access funds from the Fed at essentially 0% interest. But in a new interview with Bill Moyers, Simon Johnson noted that in August of 2009, Goldman switched again to a financial holding company. What's the difference? Johnson says that being a financial holding company means that Goldman can borrow money from the Fed at essentially no cost and then invest it in anything it wants. For example, Johnson says that Goldman has bought a large share of the stock of a Chinese automaker. Johnson says that if the investment succeeds, Goldman will reap the profits, but if it fails, the taxpayers are on the hook. Banks have the power to create money. Congresswoman Cantor also said last week, banks have the power to create money and decide how much that is worth. What's she talking about? Well, in First National Bank versus Daley, often referred to as the Credit River case, the court found that the bank created money without having the reserves. The president of the First National Bank of Montgomery admitted that all of the money or credit which was used as a consideration for the mortgage loan given to the defendant was created upon their books, that this was standard banking practice exercised by their bank in combination with the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, another private bank. Further, that he knew of no United States statute or law that gave the plaintiff bank the authority to do this. The court also held the money and credit first came into existence when they, the bank, created it. Still confused? Well, let's hear from some top economists. As PhD economist Steve Keen pointed out recently, two Nobel Prize-winning economists have shown that the assumption that reserves are created from excess deposits is not true. The model of money creation that Obama's economic advisors have sold him was shown to be empirically false over three decades ago. The first economist to establish this was the American post-Keynesian economist Basil Moore, but similar results were found by two of the staunchest neoclassic economists, Nobel Prize winner Kidland and Prescott, in a 1990 paper, Real Facts and a Monetary Myth. Looking at the timing of economic variables, they found that credit money was created about four periods before government money. However, the, quote, money multiplier model argues that government money is created first to bolster bank reserves, and then credit money is created afterwards by the process of banks lending out their increased reserves. Kidlin and Prescott observed at the end of their paper that introducing money and credit into growth theory in a way that accounts for the cyclical behavior of monetary as well as real aggregates is an important open problem in economics. In other words, if the conventional view that excess reserves, stemming either from customer deposits or government infusions of money, lead to increased lending were correct, then Kidlin and Prescott would have found that credit is extended by the banks, i.e. loaned out to customers, after the banks received infusions of money from the government. Instead, they found that the extension of credit preceded the receipt of government monies. Keen explained in an interview Friday that 25 years of research shows that creation of debt by banks precedes creation of government money, and that debt money is created first and precedes creation of credit money. As Misch has previously noted, conventional wisdom regarding the money multiplier is wrong. Australian economist Steve Keen notes that in a debt-based society, expansion of credit comes first and reserves come later. This angle of the banking system has actually been discussed for many years by leading experts. The following quote is from 1960s Chicago Federal Reserve Bank booklet entitled Modern Money Mechanics. Quote, "Banks do not really pay out loans from the money they receive as deposits. If they did this, no additional money would be created. What they do when they make loans is to accept promissory notes in exchange for credits to the borrower's transaction accounts." Close quote. And from JFK's favorite economist, John Kenneth Galbraith, "The process by which banks create money is so simple that the mind is repelled." Close quote. When a bank makes a loan, it simply adds to the borrower's deposit account in the bank by the amount of the loan. The money is not taken from anyone else's deposit. It was not previously paid into the bank by anyone. It's new money created by the bank for the use of the borrower. That was a quote from Robert P. Anderson, Secretary of the Treasury under Eisenhower, in an interview reported in 1959 issue of U.S. News and World Reports. Do private banks issue money today? Yes. Although banks no longer have the right to issue banknotes, they can create money in the form of bank deposits when they lend money to businesses or buy securities. The important thing to remember is that when banks lend money, they don't necessarily take it from anyone else to lend. Thus, they create it. That was Congressman Wright Patman, Money Facts, House Committee on Banking and Currency, 1964. The modern banking system manufactures money out of nothing. The process is perhaps the most astounding piece of sleight of hand that was ever invented. That was Sir Josiah Stamp, president of the Bank of England, and the second richest man in Britain in the 1920s. Banks create money. That's what they're for. The manufacturing process to make money consists of making an entry in a book. That's all. Each and every time a bank makes a loan, new bank credit is created. Brand new money. That was said by Graham Towers, governor of the Bank of Canada from 1935 to 1955. Sounds like these guys were in a position to know what they're talking about, doesn't it? Monetary reformers argue that the government should take the power of money creation back from the private banks and the Federal Reserve System. Indeed, PhD economist and candidate for Florida governor Fareed Kavari wants to create a Bank of the State of Florida, to create credit without burdening the state and its citizens with high interest charges by private banks. The state of North Dakota already has such a bank. My comment, interesting that we've never heard of that, isn't it? Mainstream media was too busy with other things, I guess. Back to the article. The bottom line is that monetary reformers argue that letting banks create credit and money and then charge high interest rates creates massive levels of debt for states and taxpayers. They argue that the power to create money should be reclaimed by the government and taken away from the private banks. Personally, I agree with the monetary reformers. But even for those who think this is too radical a proposition, the question is whether a system where debt has to constantly and continually expand to keep the economy afloat is sustainable. The ever-expanding bubble. In a hearing held on September 30, 1941, In the House Committee on Banking and Currency, then Chairman of the Federal Reserve, Mariner S. Eccles, said, quote, "That is what our money system is. If there were no debts in our money system, there wouldn't be any money." Indeed, Robert H. Hemphill, credit manager of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, said, "If all the bank loans were paid, no one could have a bank deposit, and there would be not a dollar of coin or currency in circulation." This is a staggering thought. We're completely dependent on the commercial banks. Someone has to borrow money, borrow every dollar we have in circulation, cash or credit. If the banks create ample synthetic money, we're prosperous. If not, we starve. We're absolutely without a permanent monetary system. When one gets a complete grasp of the picture, the tragic absurdity of our hopeless position is almost incredible. But there it is. It is the most important subject intelligent persons can investigate and reflect upon. It is so important that our present civilization may collapse unless it becomes widely understood and the defects remedied very soon. America's banking system needs to be fundamentally reformed. And I'm sorry, I do not have the source for that article. I was listening to NPR yesterday and nearly fell out of my chair. They featured a lengthy opinion piece by some doctor that urged and extolled everyone to line up and get their swine flu vaccine right now. It was blatant propaganda for the government line on swine flu. It could not have been more biased nor one-sided. There was not a single word arguing against it. NPR may be titled National Public Radio, but it's government-funded and government-controlled. This article is to counter their propaganda. I read, you decide. The source is naturalnews.com. Public support for the swine flu vaccine is evaporating by the day as the rationale for the vaccine appears increasingly ludicrous to anyone paying attention. Moms, nurses, daycare workers, and members of the general public are increasingly realizing that Big Pharma's rationale for swine flu vaccination just doesn't add up. Recent polls conducted by the mainstream media indicate that more than 50% of moms are refusing to expose their children to the swine flu vaccine, and nurses and health practitioners across the United States and United Kingdom are going vocal with their opposition to the vaccine. Legal action against the FDA's approval of the swine flu vaccine is already underway, and public protests are gaining momentum in raising awareness about the primary objections to the swine flu vaccine. Intelligent, informed people everywhere are saying no to this vaccine. Popular support for the vaccine is crumbling by the day, and health authorities are now turning to exaggerated scare stories to try and drum up demand for their vaccines. Where scientific credibility is lacking, fear is being invoked in its place. Why the swine flu vaccine doesn't add up. So why is the justification for the swine flu so flimsy? It all comes down to these five crucial reasons being pushed by the vaccine industry. But, as you'll see below, each of these five reasons is demonstrably false. Reason number one, the H1N1 swine flu pandemic is dangerous and deadly. Why it's flimsy. While the infection rate of H1N1 is currently high, the fatality rate is remarkably low. In fact, it's no higher than the normal seasonal flu. Reason number two, the vaccine protects you from the virus. Why it's flimsy. There's absolutely no scientific evidence demonstrating that the swine flu vaccine offers real-world protection against the circulating H1N1 virus. While there is evidence showing that it produces antibodies, as people who have studied vaccine effectiveness already know, the mere existence of vaccine-induced antibodies doesn't directly translate into functional real-world immunity. Vaccines are often, in effect, fabricating immunity that often doesn't provide practical immune defense in the real world. Reason number three, the vaccine is perfectly safe, even for children. Why it's flimsy. This reason is truly laughable. None of these vaccines have been properly safety tested by the FDA or the drug companies. They were approved by the FDA with a waiver, utterly bypassing the normal process of long-term safety testing that the public expects the FDA to enforce. In fact, according to attorney Jim Turner, the FDA's baseless approval of these swine flu vaccines is a violation of federal law. Reason 4. There's nothing else you can do to protect yourself from the swine flu, therefore you must take the vaccine shot. Why it's flimsy. This reason is an outright lie. In order to sell more vaccines, the pharmaceutical industry and all its bureaucratic cohorts at the CDC and WHO are intentionally keeping people ignorant of far safer and more effective options, such as vitamin D and antiviral herbal remedies. Reason 5. If you don't take the vaccine shot, you're being unethical by placing the shot burden on everyone else without taking it yourself. Why it's flimsy. Hilarious. This is marketing by guilt, trying to arm-twist people into the vaccine shot by making them feel guilty if they don't. The truth is that you're being unethical if you do get the shot, because you're financially supporting a dangerous and highly deceptive vaccine industry that's causing tremendous harm to children, expectant mothers, and other innocent vaccination victims. Hoping to improve your health by handing money to the pharmaceutical industry through the purchase of vaccines is sort of like hoping to create world peace by writing a check to weapons manufacturers. The source of that was naturalnews.com. Here's another take, also from an MD. I read, you decide. Swine flu vaccine, what to do? It's posted by Dr. Frank Lippmann. We don't know if the vaccine is safe. The FDA has authorized an expedited approval process for the swine flu vaccine, but we don't know yet if it's safe. Even GlaxoSmithKline, one of the vaccine manufacturers, has said, quote, the total population studied in clinical trials will be limited due to the need to provide the vaccine to governments as quickly as possible. Additional studies will therefore be required and conducted after the vaccine is made available. Close quote. In other words, the only thing that's safe is to say that no one knows. Since it's never been used before, and they've not had time to conduct any sufficient human testing, by getting vaccinated, you're being a human guinea pig. Another reason, vaccine manufacturers have been insulated from liability by the government. The Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius has granted legal immunity not only to the makers of the two drugs being used to treat swine flu, Tamiflu and Relenza, but also to the swine flu vaccine makers for damages due to their use against swine flu. By effectively manipulating the legal system, the pharmaceutical industry, through their powerful lobbyists, have acquired almost complete and total insulation from any liability for their vaccines and adjuvants, which are additives added to generate a stronger immune response. It is believed that it is these adjuvants which often cause the problems. The last time the government embarked on a major vaccine campaign against a new swine flu was in 1976. Thousands filed claims for side effects such as paralysis caused by the vaccine, and a number of people died. I'm sure that the researchers know more now than they did last time, and no one can say for certain that bad things will happen again or that you will suffer dire consequences if you get vaccinated. But this time, you have no legal recourse, even though this vaccine involves new factors, which makes it therefore experimental and unpredictable. By shielding the manufacturers from any responsibility for any harm caused, the pharmaceutical firms have no financial incentive to make the safest product. In fact, they have a negative incentive to test it for safety, because if they're aware of problems, then they could potentially be held liable for willful misconduct. Instead, I advise my patients to build up and strengthen their immune systems to prevent viral infections. That was Dr. Frank Lippmann in a posting on the web. The time, 12:31 in the p.m. The place, Nevada City, California. The radio station's KVMR-FM, broadcasting out of Nevada City. The radio show is Rabble Rousing. Your host is Chamba Lane. All right, let's move to Afghanistan. Afghanistan, Confessions of a Peace Activist, Letter from the Road, number 37. Rabia Elizabeth Roberts. Kabul. Armed guards, machine guns, and sandbags at every intersection, and at the door to my guest house, Open sewers and fecal dust. Traffic jams of SUVs, military convoys, bicycles, and pedestrians. Six-story buildings amidst crumbling houses and filthy refugee encampments. Men. Lots of men. Everywhere. And street children. The women in the streets are conservatively dressed, no skin showing, with big scarves. About a quarter of them wear the signature blue head-to-toe burqa. I've come to Kabul because I want to experience for myself what is happening here, 8 years after the U.S. ousted the Taliban. I've spent the past 40 years of my life protesting war and working for peace in conflict areas. I don't believe that killing leads to peace. I came here as part of a small peace delegation of mostly women, who share my conviction that President Obama must not send more troops and should set a timetable for withdrawal of the 60,000 that are here. But now, after 7 intense days and nights of interviews and meetings in Kabul, I no longer have that conviction. The best path to peace may not be the withdrawal of U.S. and NATO troops. And since the troops here now are not able to provide enough security for the Afghans to rebuild their country, it's possible more troops may be needed. It shocks me to admit this, but the voices I've heard, local and international NGO workers, that's non-government organization workers, reconciliation activists, ex-Taliban members, warlords, women in homeless shelters, and in government positions clearly do not want a withdrawal of troops now. They are under attack. The great majority of the people I listen to, not all, but the great majority, feel that additional troops are necessary to train a viable Afghan army and a national police force and to secure the country so that development projects can proceed. Yes, we should have accomplished those goals by now, but we have not. Dr. Saraya, a dedicated and hopeful Afghan physician who was Commissioner for Women's Rights, told us, quote, "If the international troops leave Afghanistan now, it could be a humanitarian disaster. There will be chaos and rape again." I'm not the only one in our delegation who had to confront this disparity between our preconvictions and the reality we found. This disparity became a serious tension in our group. After the second day of appointments with most of the Afghans, we met expressing support for the presence of troops. One of the leaders of our delegation said, quote, "I don't like what I'm hearing." So she changed her style of questioning. For example, when she asked, "Do you want the troops to leave?" the answers she received were mostly no. So she began asking questions like, "Do you want development and jobs? Or do you want the money spent on more troops?" Sure enough, more people began to say they wanted jobs, not war. This was the soundbite she wanted. In my younger days as a social researcher for national-scale projects, I learned a great deal about survey questioning. You can get the answer you're looking for by limiting the options presented in the question. A more accurate approach is to formulate questions that are essentially open-ended, questions that do not in themselves limit the field of the answer. So when I ask the same people, "Do you feel Afghanistan can develop economically and socially at this time without military security?" the answer was no. We need an army. The coalition forces must stay and train an army of 250,000 Afghans. Until that happens, we need U.S. troops to secure the border with Pakistan so the Taliban stop coming and going from their training camps there. I came to Kabul to listen and learn and to report back home what I witnessed. While I respect the heart values of those of my colleagues who insist on reporting only Afghan voices that support their position, I feel that the simplicity of sound bites like, "No more troops," risks misleading the American people about their responsibility to the people of Afghanistan and about how their own security interests are intertwined in the region. A snapshot of 3 decades of war. America is not an innocent bystander to the situation in Afghanistan, and neither is Britain, Russia, Pakistan, or Iran. Over the past 30 years, American policies have shown an appalling lack of long-range thinking, as well as arrogance and ignorance about the culture and political forces at play in the region. In 1979, Soviet troops invaded Afghanistan to bolster a faltering communist government. Blinded by Cold War rhetoric, the CIA spent the next 10 years funding and arming an indigenous insurgency called the Mujahideen, or also known as Mr. Wilson's War. So the U.S. couldn't be called to account. Those funds were moved through the Pakistan Intelligence Services, the ISI, who served their own needs by directing arms and money to the most fundamentalist of the Islamic warlords involved, slowly freezing out the moderate and nationalist leaders. When the Soviets withdrew in 1989, the U.S. breathed a sigh of relief and promptly forgot about Afghanistan. With 1.5 million Afghans killed in the war and 4 million more banished to squalid refugee camps, the country was in disarray. But the Mujahideen militias divided along tribal lines had become accustomed to fighting and the thrill of living near death. Almost as soon as the Mujahideen took over, rivalries exploded into civil war. Armed with the weapons we supplied them, they plunged the country into another devastating 6 years of war. Many Afghans welcomed the Talibs as they poured out of their conservative madrasas over the border from Pakistan and offered to put an end to the chaos. But the Taliban victory was soon its own scourge on the people of Afghanistan. They imposed severe social and religious sanctions on the populace and welcomed the money and recruits that came from Saudi Arabia and Pakistan with the express purpose of challenging Western-style civilization. 3 weeks after 9/11, American forces attacked Afghanistan. 3 months later, the Taliban had melted away. Obsessed with cultivating war with Iraq, we left the job in Afghanistan unfinished, with inadequate security, force, little money for reconstruction, and little attention to the growing drug trade that was funding renewed terrorist activities. The Taliban and Al-Qaeda moved to Pakistan to regroup, recruit, and then return to destabilize the provincial and national governments of Afghanistan. I want to quibble with one thing she's saying there, and that is she's saying the growing drug trade. My understanding was one of the things the Taliban did was they wiped out the drug trade, and that only came back after they were deposed. Back to her article. Americans are now tired of the war of choice in Iraq. Faced with enormous domestic problems, Americans understandably want to be rid of the Afghan problem again. After 8 years of misguided bombing raids to, quote, kill Taliban, who are living in villages surrounded by civilians, we've created a new multi-headed enemy. Today, the Taliban are different from the original fundamentalists who waged a war in the name of Islam. According to the director of the peace and reconciliation process in Kabul, only about 10-15% of Taliban are ideologically motivated today. The rest are a combination of poor villagers angry at U.S. bombing, out-of-work youth, former militia, drug smugglers, plain thugs, and those from the countryside who distrust any national government, no matter who it is. Most of them, the director told us, if offered money, land, jobs, and personal security, would put down their weapons and come in. Why is this mess our problem? Why should the boys and girls from Indiana and Texas, who I talked with at Edgar Military Base in Kabul, come here to risk their lives for the security of these people? Why? Because the U.S. has been intimately involved in creating this mess, and we have a moral responsibility to these people to help clean it up. And in terms of our own self-interest, if we turn our back on Afghanistan now, it will almost certainly come back to haunt us. What does clean it up mean? It means we have to do many, many things differently from how we've been doing them for over the past 30 years. In my next letter, I will try and outline a few of those courses of action. And to listeners, I'll try and get a hold of that letter. A listener sent this, and I'm hoping they'll send me the next one. Back to her letter. Many analysts say the U.S. is using the war on terrorism as an excuse to expand its military power in order to access resources throughout the region. This may be true. After 40 years of peace activism, it's hard to trust the military establishment and the industry behind it. Basically, I don't. Yet I know if the international forces leave Afghanistan now without securing the country, there will be a great deal more violence here, and it will very likely spread beyond these borders. Consider the alternatives. Without an international military presence, there is a good chance that money and influence from neighboring Pakistan, Russia, Uzbekistan, Iran, not to mention Saudi Arabia, will plunge the country back into civil war. Then there's the enormous success of the illegal heroin trade in the region since the U.S. invasion. Today, in the south of the country, drug production and transport pays the bills and cements the loyalties of hundreds of tribal chieftains who were involved in the trade. This could easily become a narco state, funneling half of its profits to terrorist groups around the world. Two other options are a successful Taliban victory, establishing another repressive, woman-hating, terrorist-supporting regime, fueled by drug money, or maybe simply a failed state in perpetual war, continuously destabilizing the whole region. Any of these outcomes would stimulate an increase in Islamic militancy and global terrorism. The dilemma of the peace activist. Peace workers are against violence. We protest all war. Military adventurism and the pervasiveness of the military-industrial complex appall us. I liked it better when I knew what the moral high ground in Afghanistan was, troop withdrawal. But my experience from this intense week in Kabul has given me pause. I feel we have to admit a terrible truth. The standard anti-war position of bring the troops home now is in itself a violent policy. It will precipitate extreme violence. The opposite position, maintaining current troop levels or adding more, also means more violence. But after all that has happened, the U.S. has a responsibility to help Afghans fashion a sovereign country capable of human decency. The writer was Rabia Elizabeth Roberts. She's been a peace activist for over 40 years. Here's another perspective on Afghanistan. It's titled, What Lies Beneath the War in Afghanistan? It's by Eric Margolis, column, and he's a columnist for the Toronto Sun, republished in Smirking Chimp. Truth is war's first casualty. The Afghans' war's biggest untruth is, we've got to fight terrorists over there so we don't have to fight them at home. Many North Americans still buy this lie because they believe the 9/11 attacks came directly from the Afghanistan-based Al-Qaeda and Taliban movements. False. The 9/11 attacks were planned in Germany and Spain and conducted mainly by U.S.-based Saudis to punish America for supporting Israel. Okay, let me interrupt to say I disagree strongly with that perspective, and I think I've established amply on this show previously that it was not what the what our government says it was. But let's continue with this guy's article. Taliban, a militant religious anti-communist movement of Pashtun tribesmen, was totally surprised by 9/11. Taliban received U.S. aid until May 2001. The CIA was planning to use Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda to stir up Muslim Uyghurs against Chinese rule and Taliban against Russia's Central Asian allies. Al-Qaeda only numbered 300 members. Most have been killed. A handful escaped to Pakistan. Only a few remain in Afghanistan. Yet President Barack Obama insists 68,000 or more U.S. troops must stay in Afghanistan to fight Al-Qaeda and prevent extremists from reacquiring terrorist training camps. Again, I think that that's not quite the entire picture there. I think Obama wants to fight against the Taliban as well as Al-Qaeda. But those are my thoughts. Back to the article. This claim, like Saddam Hussein's non-existent weapons of mass destruction, is a handy slogan to market war to the public. Today, half of Afghanistan is under Taliban control. Anti-American militants could more easily use Somalia, Indonesia, Bangladesh, North and West Africa, or Sudan. They don't need remote Afghanistan. The 9/11 attacks were planned in apartments, not camps. The United States should not be waging war on Taliban. However backwards and oafish its Pashtun tribesmen, they have no desire or interest in attacking America, even less Canada. Taliban are the sons of the U.S.-backed Mujahideen who defeated the Soviets in the 1980s. As I've been saying since 9/11, Taliban never was America's enemy. Instead of invading Afghanistan in 2001, the U.S. should have paid Taliban to uproot Al-Qaeda. The Pashtun tribes want to end foreign occupation and drive out the Afghan communists, who now dominate the U.S.-installed Kabul regime. Well, I don't know about that statement either. I don't know if they're communists. I do know that Hamid Karzai was an employee of Unocal Oil. Condoleezza Rice was an executive in Unocal Oil. I would say these guys aren't communists. I'd say they're probably first-class cutthroat capitalists. Back to the article. But the U.S. has blundered into a full-scale war, not just with Taliban, but with most of Afghanistan's fierce Pashtun tribes, who comprise over half the population. Obama's wrestling with widening the war. After 8 years of military operations costing $236 billion, the U.S. commander in Afghanistan just warned of the threat of failure, also known as defeat. Canada so far wasted $16 billion Canadian dollars on the war. Western occupation forces will be doomed if the Afghan resistance ever gets modern anti-aircraft and anti-tank missiles. The U.S. is sinking ever deeper into the South Asian morass. Washington is trying to arm-twist Pakistan into being more obedient and widening the war against its own independent-minded Pashtun tribes, wrongly called Taliban. Washington's incredibly ham-handed efforts to use $7.5 billion U.S. to bribe Pakistan's feeble, corrupt government and army, take control of military promotions, and get a grip on Pakistan's nuclear arsenal have Pakistan's soldiers on the verge of revolt. Obama has been under intense pressure from flag-waving Republicans, much of the media, and the hawkish national security establishment to expand the war. Israel's supporters, including many congressional Democrats, want to see the U.S. seize Pakistan's nuclear arms and expand the Afghan war into Iran. Obama should admit Taliban is not and never was a threat to the West, that the wildly exaggerated Al-Qaeda have been mostly eradicated, and that the U.S.-led war in Afghanistan is causing more damage to U.S. interests in the Muslim world, now 25% of all humanity, than bin Laden and his new few ragtag allies. The bombings in Madrid and London and conspiracy in Toronto were all horribly wrong-headed protests by young Muslims against the Afghan war. We are not going to change the way Afghans treat their women by waging war on them or bring democracy through rigged elections. I wish Obama would just declare victory in Afghanistan, withdraw Western forces, and hand over security to a multinational stabilization force from Muslim nations. Good presidents, like good generals, know when to retreat. That was Eric Margolis, who's a columnist for the Toronto Sun, and that gives you two differing perspectives on Afghanistan. Okay, a bit on health care reform. Insurers make case for public option. This is by Robert Parry, reprinted from consortiumnews.com, republished in opednews.com. By demanding that the Baucus health care bill toughen the coercive penalties to force young Americans to sign up for private insurance, industry lobbyists have inadvertently made the most dramatic argument to date for including a strong public option in any health reform law. After all, the bill sponsored by Senate Finance Committee Chairman Max Baucus already was widely regarded as industry-friendly. It had scrapped the public option, a lower-cost government-run insurance alternative that the industry hated because it would create tough competitive pressures. Plus, there appeared to be plenty of goodies for the industry. The Baucus bill, which is expected to clear the Finance Committee on Tuesday, and it did clear, would impose an individual mandate on Americans requiring them to buy insurance or face a government fine. The bill also contained government subsidies to help modest-income citizens pay for their insurance. So the industry stood to gain an estimated $27 million new customers and get federal subsidies to boot. But industry lobbyists began to send signals last week that they wanted more. They feared that the government fines would not be coercive enough to force many healthy young Americans to sign up for insurance, meaning that many new customers might be just the ones the industry doesn't want, people who are sick and need medical attention. Without more severe government penalties on young Americans, the lobbyists warned that the industry would jack up rates on everyone. Between 2010 and 2019, the cumulative increases in the cost of a typical family policy under this reform proposal will be approximately $20,700, more than it would be under the current system. This was said by Karen Ignaji, President and Chief Executive of America's Health Insurance Plans, the industry's lobbying arm, which commissioned the pricey study by PricewaterhouseCoopers. In other words, the private health insurance industry is demanding more concessions in the reform bill, particularly stiffer fines on Americans who balk at signing up for health insurance, or the industry will make health insurance even more expensive for Americans. Yet, while the industry may view its new hardball tactics as smart politics, its threats of sharply higher insurance premiums may backfire. The admission that the industry can't control costs without greater government coercion on citizens may end up simply dramatizing the value of a strong public option. The public option, which could cut costs by piggybacking on the existing Medicare bureaucracy, was always the one possible route to substantial savings. Based on Medicare's experience, a public option could operate with an overhead of around 2% compared to the 20% or more that private insurers take for administrative costs, executive salaries, and profits. If a public option were available to individual consumers and small businesses, as four bills that have passed other congressional committees call for, then customers could get coverage at a lower price, and thus the mandate to buy insurance would be less burdensome. Rather than strong-arming Americans to get private insurance by imposing stiffer fines, Congress must find the public option a far less draconian alternative. That, of course, was the reason private insurers worked so hard to demonize the public option as a government takeover, of Medicine and lobbied aggressively to make sure it was rejected by the Senate Finance Committee. Lobbied hell, they bought them off. Yet even with a public option stripped from the Baucus bill, Congress finds the industry ratcheting up the pressure to get more concessions or to kill the reform package altogether. The industry's move, however, represents a gamble in that Democrats might finally recognize the potential for their own political suicide if a new health reform law turns the federal government into the enforcer for an industry that has long prospered from the business of paying as few medical bills of sick Americans as possible. Rather than using fines to muscle more citizens into the arms of private insurers, the Democrats might finally rebel against the lobbyists and make sure that a strong public health insurance option is available as an alternative to private policies. Just the outcome that the industry feared most. Robert Perry, reprinted from consortiumnews.com. Well, once more, too many articles, not enough time. I think I got time to whip through this one. Harry Reid, Future Health Insurance Lobbyist, by Rob Call. Looks like Harry Reid's going to follow his predecessor, Tom Daschle's path. He's going to lose his re-election effort and become a lobbyist, a proponent for the healthcare industry. Looks like he's started already. Doesn't have to go that way. Reid could be a hero instead of a zero and get tough. That's unlikely because if he's going to do that, he would have dumped Max Baucus as head of the Senate Finance Committee and would not have included him and Chris Dodd as part of the triumvirate designed to shepherd the healthcare reform through the Senate. There's not much time. If Reid gets real reform passed, he might salvage his career, his legacy, and place in history. We now know that at least 45,000 people die in America each year. Some right-wing Neanderthals in both parties might argue that some of those dead are not legal residents. Lots of heart there. I'm not going to go further with this one. There's not enough meat in it. Yeah, a little more. I'm not saying it would be easy. Pelosi should have disobeyed Rahm Emanuel and the White House cowards who were afraid of pursuing legal justice. She should have directed John Conyers to hold hearings about Bush, Cheney, Gonzalez, and the Justice Department, Rove-directed attorneys. The Republicans would have screamed bloody murder, but by now the truth would be out and they would be exposed as protecting criminals. But there's no accountability in the House and the right was given a free ride. Maybe Obama and company thought that would get them Olympia Stowe, senator for the state of 1.3 million. But there's no corruption narrative to distract the right wing, so they created a narrative out of thin air. Tea parties, birthers, deathers, and the media filled the vacuum. Pelosi and Reid failed to fill, since Patrick Leahy would have been happy to go after the aforementioned criminals if Harry Reid had encouraged him. So we face a situation where Max Baucus, representing less than 1 million people out of 307 million, has such outrageous power. The Senate should be abolished as an archaic element of our government that is destroying America, but that's another story. But Harry Reid could have dealt with Baucus. The health insurers bought Baucus and others for a few million bucks. Reid could have coordinated with Obama to throw pork for their respective states at the reform-resistant senators to pull them away from their loyalty to the insurers. Well, more pork. I'm sure they're already using that lure. The Democrats need to hammer the handful of blue dog senators who are threatening not to hold strong to block filibusters. Reid should be able to do that, but that's not enough. If we get the health care bill Baucus has offered, Reid's a failure. Dodd's a failure, and Baucus is a traitor. That's right, a traitor. America's in the middle of a battle. It's being fought between corporations and their intermediaries and the American people. So far, the American people are losing and have been for years. Reid will lose his Senate seat because he chose the corporate side. I hope I'm wrong. I hope Reid, after years of being a jellyfish, shows some spine. Okay, you've heard enough of that. The economy, how bad is it? The economy is so bad that I got a pre-declined credit card in the mail. The economy is so bad, I ordered a burger at McDonald's, and the kid behind the counter asked, "Can you afford fries with that?" The economy is so bad that CEOs are now playing miniature golf. The economy is so bad, if the bank returns your check marked insufficient funds, you call them and ask if they mean you or them. The economy is so bad, Hot Wheels and Matchbox stocks are trading higher than General Motors. The economy is so bad, McDonald's is selling the quarter ouncer. The economy is so bad, parents in Beverly Hills fired their nannies and learned their children's names. The economy is so bad, a truckload of Americans was caught sneaking into Mexico. The economy is so bad, Dick Cheney took his stockbroker hunting. The economy is so bad, Motel 6 won't leave the light on anymore. The economy is so bad, the mafia is laying off judges. And the economy is so bad, ExxonMobil laid off 25 congressmen. And finally, Congress says they're looking into the Bernard Madoff scandal. Great. The guy who made $50 billion disappear is being investigated by the people who made $1.5 trillion disappear. Okay, that's it from here. Next week, please remember that we're having a pledge drive. I'm doing a pledge drive special. I'm going to have a fascinating guest. He is an Arabic and Islamic studies scholar. He has some very interesting perspectives on the Middle East. I'm sure you'll enjoy it.